will talk this hour with the author of the book, Breach of Trust, How Americans Failed Their Soldiers and Their Country. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and we will welcome your thoughts on whether the all-volunteer Army, military, has been a mistake, and whether we need a national service program for 18-year-olds to serve their country, either in the military or in another capacity, to bridge the disconnect that our guest says exists between Americans and our military, a divide that he says has resulted in too much war and too few warriors. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Andrew Basevich, professor of history and international relations at Boston University. His most recent book is Breach of Trust, How Americans Failed Their Soldiers and Their Country. Good morning.
Good morning.
So why do you say we have failed our military? Don't we all support our troops?
Well, we all purport to support our troops, but I've come to believe that support is more symbolic than substantial. The reality is that the troops have been hung out to dry, being sent to wage unnecessary wars, mismanaged wars, bearing consequences that are mostly negative as a result, and the American people sit on the sidelines, applaud, and allow this to happen.
Yeah, and why is the volunteer military to blame in part for this?
Well, let me answer the question by trying to put it in a broader historical context. For roughly the first two centuries of our existence as a republic, the citizen soldier formed the foundation of our military system. We have forgotten, but prior to World War II, the United States maintained a relatively small army in peacetime, and when emergencies arose, whether a desire to take California from Mexico or a need to fight to preserve the Union, we raised up a people's army for that specific purpose. And the people's army, not without deficiencies, by and large performed admirably well in achieving victory, victory in the Civil War, victory in World War I, victory in World War II. That system collapsed in Vietnam. Certainly an unnecessary war and a mismanaged war. And one of the consequences of that war is that the American people abandon the tradition of the citizen soldier. Richard Nixon ratifying that decision when he ended the draft and created the all-volunteer force. Now, at the time, this seemed like a good idea. The Americans had no interest, by and large, in military service. We're pretty much disgusted with war. And by the time the all-volunteer force began to mature in the late 1980s and into the 1990s, it looked like a quite effective force. It looked like a good deal. We had a good military, and the rest of us basically didn't have any responsibilities in that regard and weren't called upon to make any sacrifices. But I've come to believe that since 9/11, we can see why this seemingly wise reform was a mistake. Because, in fact, what's happened is that we've surrendered control over our military. It is no longer America's army. It's Washington's army. And some listeners may disagree, but I think that Washington has abused that army, has abused our military in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in the feckless, over-militarized policies that we have pursued. So the basis of my argument is to say that if we could close this gap between the military and society, if we could re-engage the American people with the policies undertaken in Washington, perhaps we could get Washington to exercise a certain amount of self-restraint, and we would therefore protect our soldiers from the sort of abuse they've been subjected to.
But you are not calling for a reinstatement of the draft?
Well, no, I'm not. I talk about that in the book as one option. But I think the option is politically infeasible. And so I suggest that as an alternative, what we might do is to consider a program of national service. And you hinted at what that would mean in your introduction, that It would be based on the principle that, citizenship entails responsibilities, obligations, not simply a claim on privileges. And implementing that could see something like all 18-year-olds spending a time in service to country or community, with some young people spending that service in as a period of military service, and others being engaged in a variety of other ways of, contributing, whether Peace Corps, Teach for America, perhaps a new a civilian conservation corps. There could be a variety of things. And my argument is that a program of national service could, A, close the gap between the military and society and perhaps lay the foundation for more responsible military policies, but also, B, that it could enrich our conception of citizenship by making it clear that citizenship does, in fact, entail obligations.
Yeah. Wouldn't the 18-year-olds who would volunteer for the military anyway volunteer for the military, and everybody else who doesn't want to do the other things?
Well, I suppose it could be, but we could create incentives, I think, that would make military service more desirable, at least to some people, and I would hope, therefore, give us a military that was more like the rest of American society than is the case now. That would be my hope. It would require a certain amount of thought and careful management in order to get that result.
Yeah. Talk a little bit more, though, on how this would bridge that gap that you say exists between Americans and their military and the policies, the military policies.
Well, and you know, maybe I'm naive here, but the book spends a chapter talking about World War II. World War II as a war that was fought by citizen soldiers, and the war that was fought was a war that, where the military is very much reflective of society, that the sons of the wealthy, the sons of the powerful, athletes, entertainers, all were involved in the waging of that war. It was a people's war. It was a war that ended successfully. Now, that was a military that was created by a draft that swept up millions of young men, and we don't need millions of young men and women under arms at the present moment. But I would hope that the program of national service, given that everybody would serve in some capacity, could be managed in a way that we'd end up with a military that reflected our society, which I believe is not the case now, and it is the distance between the military and society that arguably is one of the reasons why our military policies have been both irresponsible and unsuccessful. You know, people talk about the great military we have, and in some measures it is a great military, but the fact of the matter is it doesn't win. We didn't win the war in Iraq. We're not going to win the war in Afghanistan. And that alone should give us pause for thought. Why undertake these terrible struggles that last so long and cost so much when the outcome is other than success?
And you also note that we have to have private contractors in addition to the military.
Well, again, in the intro, you mentioned that, you know, too much war, too few warriors. If you have a people's army, and the war that you've engaged in turns out to be other than what you expected. And that's not uncommon. War is an uncertain proposition. But if the basis of the military system is the citizen soldier, then it becomes possible to create a larger army, to generate more warriors when you have too much war. But with our professional military, that's not possible. And so when, after 9/11, the plans concocted in Washington went awry, plans that assumed we'd have a short war ending in victory in Afghanistan and a short war ending in victory in Iraq, when those assumptions didn't pan out, what the Bush administration, this is a decision endorsed by the Obama administration, what the Bush administration did, of course, was to close the gap between too much war and too few warriors by hiring civilian contractors, in effect, mercenaries. Now, war has always been, for some people, a money-making enterprise. It's certainly true. But what we have done since 9/11 is to open the floodgates, and war becomes primarily a money-making enterprise. And the institutions that seize these opportunities are interested only in one thing, and that is making money. And so in opening the doors for these so-called private security firms, we've also opened the doors for vast amounts of corruption, some of which I try to document in the book.
On Facebook, Tom writes, "The problem with a volunteer military is that it allows the politicians to start wars without public involvement. When people are forced to send their children to war, they may pay attention to whether or not it's a good war."
Well, I mean, Tom is doing a better job of summarizing the book than I probably am doing, although I think I just take issue with the notion of force. I think to a considerable degree, Nixon's decision to end the draft, and he was doing that for typically Nixonian motives, meaning they were nefarious, Nixon's decision, I think, permanently removed the state's authority to conscript. As a people, in the 20th century, up until Vietnam, we accepted in World War I, in World War II, and in the early Cold War, that the state had this authority to command somebody to serve in the military and march off to war. I think that authority, in effect, ended when we terminated the draft at the end of the Vietnam period. And so to force, to say that we should, that forcing people to serve, I don't think it's going to happen. And that's why the national service proposition tries to navigate around that by establishing a much broader-based obligation to serve the country, but not necessarily insisting that service to the country should be confined simply to, picking up an assault rifle.
Our guest is Andrew Bacevich. He is a professor of history and international relations at Boston University. We're talking with him about his book, Breach of Trust: How Americans Failed Their Soldiers and Their Country. And we welcome your questions. We welcome your thoughts on this. Do you think that Americans are disconnected from the hardships of war? Are we failing our military? Would we be better off with a citizen military or some sort of national service program? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking about our nation's military this hour and how our guest says that the volunteer military has left us with too few warriors and too much war. We're talking about how Americans have failed their soldiers and their country. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Andrew Bacevich is a military historian. He's a Vietnam veteran, and he is the author of Breach of Trust. Let's take some calls. We have Victor in West Allis with us. Hello, Victor.
Well, hi. I sort of disagree. I'm a veteran. I served in the Navy from 62 to 65 on a destroyer. The amount of money the government spends to train an individual is enormous. Now, if we can get people to stay in and become lifers, the government and the country benefits from all that years of experience, okay?
Yeah.
So therefore, a volunteer military is, I think, far superior. Now, I agree with your guest that our politicians think that we're expendable people, and yet people like us who are, we call ourselves true patriots, are willing to forfeit our lives like police officers as well as firemen. And these people should be admired and stand up and come forward and say, I'll put on a uniform. Yes, I realize I may have to forfeit my life, but I would only like to do it if it's absolutely necessary.
Well, thank you, Victor. What about that, Andrew Basevich?
I think the first point, there's merit to it in the sense that if we would imagine that the term of national service is 2 years, then the typical 18-year-old is going to come in, undergo 6 to 9 months of training, and then only be available for a year or so of service before returning to civilian life. So the training bill is probably going to go up. Indeed, there are certain specialties, and I mentioned this in the book, where clearly you're not going to, wouldn't make any sense to do a 2-year term of service. So an individual who wanted to be a fighter pilot would have to agree to a longer term of service. It would take 2 or 3 or 4 years to learn the trade, and then they would have to stand for a longer period of time. So you have to make adjustments in the term of service based on the complexity of the specialty. On the other hand, you know, the notion that the professional military is cheaper is a little bit tough to sustain. That argument was made at the time in the discussion over whether or not to end the draft back in the late 60s and early 1970s, and certain economists argued that simply from the point of view of economics, it would make sense to go to a professional military. But I have to say it's hard to see that that's sustained by the facts. I mean, if you look at the amount of money that we spend, that we hand to the Pentagon, in order to maintain a substantially smaller force, it's costing us a ton of money. So yes, probably longer term of service would be required to train people for certain specialties. No, I'm not persuaded that when you get to the bottom line, that the professional military saves us money.
Thanks very much for the call. Let's go now to Rob in Madison. Hi, Rob.
Good morning. I just had a couple points, and I'd like to say I agree with Mr. Basevich, and I haven't even read his book, but you're very articulate, sir. My points, I guess I have been doing too much thinking, but what I've noticed from, you know, some time now, actually 12 years since the past administration, was how that administration basically addicted the American people to terror. So our inactions as a country are due to this terror addiction. You see, just like any addiction, the first step to getting better is to admit the addiction. And too many Americans are not doing this. I feel the proof of this is in no small part due to the Entertainment America watch. Just go to a video store, look at what they rent America, you know, and it's... It turns my stomach.
Well, so do you think that what do you think ought to happen, Rob?
Well, if everybody had a job, that would help, and if we had this program Mr. Basevich speaks of, I think that would benefit everyone, kind of like the CC, you know, back in the old days. It brought us back on our feet. Yeah. We don't need the military to do that. We don't need, I mean, there were no weapons of mass destruction. Bush and Cheney both admitted that in their memoirs. But, of course, people don't read those. Therein lies the problem.
Yeah, well, thank you. You do talk about the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and that they were unnecessary wars, that we're not winning those wars. Tell us why the volunteer army is to blame for that, Andrew Basevich.
Well, Rob used the phrase addicted to terror. I think I'd use a different phrase, addicted to war or addicted to the conviction or committed to the conviction that military power is the most effective instrument of policy. And this, is a longer story, a story I tell in a different book, that in the wake of Vietnam, that catastrophic failure, a variety of groups, the officer corps, neoconservatives, Protestant, conservative Protestant evangelicals, the Republican Party, to some degree the entertainment industry, all for different reasons saw in the restoration of American military might the way to achieve their purposes, usually argued in terms of what was necessary to protect the country. And by the 1990s, these arguments prevailed, and we had become infatuated with war. And one expression of this infatuation with war is this, to my mind, superficial claim of supporting the troops. And so when we get to 9/11, the American people, in a sense, are preconditioned to embrace a global war on terrorism as the correct response to the events of 9/11. And it wasn't. I mean, to wage a global war on terrorism, on the face of it, is folly. It's silly. It cannot succeed. But we bought into that, and by buying into that, we allowed people like President George W. Bush and Vice President Cheney wide latitude in deciding how to use our military. Where does the all-volunteer force fit in? Well, the disconnect between the American military and society, exaggerated expectations of what military power wielded by a professional force could achieve, I think helped to create the conditions for the misguided policies that we found in the wake of 9/11.
Yeah, you know, I thought Rob was going to also discuss that 9/11 boosted the need for military service, but today, what you speak of is not necessary. We don't have the need for the warriors.
It is certainly true. In the immediate wake of 9/11, there was a little uptick in recruiting. There were some number of Americans who said, my country has been attacked, and I want to be part of defending the country. But it was only the most abbreviated uptick. And in that context, we have to remember George W. Bush's charge to us as citizens in this enterprise that he depicted as of historic importance, you know, our freedoms under siege, we will go defend our freedoms. And his charge to us was to go shopping, to continue to consume, to ensure that the American economy based on a consumption would continue to function appropriately. So he let us off the hook, and he let us off the hook because he assumed that this professional military that we created after Vietnam was unbeatable. He assumed that there was no need to engage the American people in this global war on terrorism that he declared and that he said was going to be some vast historic enterprise. And we did as he asked. We disengaged, and we were content then, and we remain content with symbolic expressions of appreciation for soldiers that do not entail any sacrifice on our parts.
Our next caller is Jerry in Glendale. Hello, Jerry.
Hello. Thank you very much for this very interesting discussion. I fully support the guest's position. Back in 1970, I was a conscientious objector. I did 2 years of alternate service at the ripe age of 22. It brought me into a full appreciation that I had accountability and responsibility to give back to my country. I think today there are vast segments of our country, especially in the middle class, who are very disconnected from foreign policy as well as other responsible involvements in the world. I work in a university environment. I see young people really having no sense that they're connected to other people and that they have a responsibility to the country. I think national service would give young people an opportunity to really focus their energies, feel more fully a part of being a member, a citizen of a country. And I also think it would really challenge the current situation. The volunteer army, in my understanding, is it draws primarily from several southern impoverished states. It would equalize the involvement in national service. I think for people who got into national service, if they went into the military, stacked the benefits for people that put themselves in harm's way. I just think there's incredible benefits to what the author is really proposing here.
Thanks very much for the call. Do you have a response, Professor Basevich?
I'm just amazed that you keep getting guests who make the case for my book better than I do.
We have smart listeners. Talk a little bit more about why the citizen-soldier system collapsed during the Vietnam War. I remember my brothers, one actually joined the Navy because he thought he would be drafted and he wanted to have his choice of military service. The other didn't get drafted because he had the college deferment going. But boy, that was a tense time in our household around that time. Why did the citizen soldier system collapse?
Well, I think several factors converged to bring that about. One I think was the temper of the times. We should neither exaggerate nor should we forget the extent to which the 60s was a time of challenging conventional wisdom and authority. Madison itself, the university, mm-hmm. Was one of the places where these questions were being asked most insistently, particularly in the realm of American history, which is the discipline that I was trained in. And the Wisconsin School of Diplomatic Historians, led by William Appleman Williams, but with his numerous students participating, posing fundamental questions about the engine of U.S. foreign policy, both before the Cold War and during the Cold War, and in that sense, raising doubts about whether or not U.S. policy deserved to be simply acceded to. So that was one factor. A second factor, I think, was the inability of the Johnson administration to make the case for the necessity of the Vietnam War. They tried hard enough, but they couldn't persuade sufficient numbers of the American people that maintaining the existence of South Vietnam constituted a vital U.S. national security interest worth expending enormous amounts of American blood and treasure. And then a third factor was the fact that the war was fought so badly. That was a military failure of American military leadership facing a difficult problem, couldn't figure out how to solve the problem. And therefore, we ended up with a war that just dragged on at enormous cost in terms of lives. And then I think the fourth thing was, and the caller alluded to it, the draft had become unfair.
Mm-hmm.
The draft was something that could be gamed. The draft was something that those who actually ended up being conscripted were people who couldn't figure out how to successfully gamed it. So it was manifestly unjust. So for all those reasons, I think that created the conditions in which the draft simply became unsustainable. And Nixon, well, it wasn't so much that Nixon ended the draft, is that Nixon acknowledged that the draft had become illegitimate and therefore there was a need to move to another system.
Yeah. I think I heard you say that when he acknowledged that the draft wasn't working and it was ended, he did so for nefarious reasons?
Well, this is not an argument. It's original with me, but it's one that I find persuasive. Nixon becomes president in January of 1969, and he had run for office saying he had a secret plan to end the war in Vietnam. He didn't have any secret plan. And he soon found out that the war was going to continue on his watch, and he established his objective as wanting to find a way to extricate the United States from this debacle with minimum damage. And ironically, the way to do that was to extend the war, so that he could implement his plan for so-called Vietnamization, handing the war back to the Vietnamese to let them wage it. He needed to buy time. One way to buy time was to try to cut the anti-war movement off at its knees. He calculated that ending the draft would have students from the University of Wisconsin and Boston University be less concerned about being sent off to fight a war that they didn't want to fight, and therefore more inclined to go back into the classroom, and therefore allowing him to do what he wanted to do.
Wow. I mentioned to our listeners that you are a Vietnam War veteran. I did not mention to our listeners that your own son was killed serving in Iraq in 2007. I'm very sorry for your loss, but did those experiences shape the arguments you make in the book?
Well, of course, although I don't think, you know, there's a tendency to point to some aspect of a person's life and say, aha, this must be why you think the way you do. And I think that that's an oversimplification. We are a product of our experiences. But our experiences, my experiences, go beyond simply the fact that I served and that my son served and was lost. I mean, I think I am who I am because I grew up in the Midwest, because I'm a Catholic, because of the family, the environment in which I was raised. I think that there's a whole host of reasons. And I would emphasize that my concerns about our military system and my critique of our excessive use of military power certainly predates my son's death.
Our guest is Andrew Basevich. He is a professor of history and international relations at Boston University. We are talking with him about his most recent book, Breach of Trust, How Americans Failed Their Soldiers and Their Country. Yeah, in it argues that without the draft or without some sort of program of national service, that our country, that Americans have become disconnected with their military, and this has led to unnecessary wars and wars that are not won. And we wonder what you think, what questions you have. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, talking with Andrew Basevich, author of Breach of Trust, How Americans Failed Their Soldiers and Their Country, talking about how right now only a small minority of Americans fight in wars and suffer the consequences, while the rest of the country cheerleads on their behalf but doesn't otherwise contribute. And I'm wondering, Andrew Basevich, before we go back to the phones, are there other countries that have all volunteer militaries, or other countries that have a mandatory military?
I've kind of lost track of the military policy in other countries, but certainly, for example, the United Kingdom has a volunteer professional military and has for some considerable period of time. At the opposite end of the spectrum would be Israel, which has a citizens' army, mandatory service, very considerable reserve service requirements, and that's really been a signature of Israel's approach to governance since the creation of the state back in the late 1940s. And you might say, well, what's the difference? I think, if Great Britain can have a professional military and not go off the deep end, why can't we? Mm-hmm. I think that the answer has something to do with our sense of ourselves. In other books, I've written about American exceptionalism and this notion of chosenness, this belief that somehow we have some special mission to history that we have to accomplish. I think the notion is a bogus one. But for those who wish to go charging off into some new war, the deep-seated sense of our chosenness is something that they can exploit in order to generate popular enthusiasm for war.
Let's go to Chris in Columbus now. Hi, Chris.
Hey, great show as usual, Joy. Just wanted to point out a couple things. Number one, American exceptionalism is the fact that America is the only country that codifies in written law at our founding the individual right of things. And number two, I am a current serving member of the military, and it is extremely hard to keep an all-volunteer force fit and ready for duty. I'm in charge of the remedial physical training program because even with all volunteers, our culture is so sedentary that the troops, young troops today, are not capable of doing the mission without constant supervision. And forcing conscripts to participate would make it even harder and then therefore cost more money.
I think there's no question that from the perspective of those who lead the services, a professional force is more convenient. It makes their job easier. And in that sense, I would fully expect that members of the officer corps would be among the last ones to agree with what I'm proposing. Interestingly, however, there are a number of voices of recently retired very senior officers who are now beginning to question whether the all-volunteer force actually serves the interests of the country. Lieutenant General Carl Eikenberry, who after retiring served as the U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, has written a very important article questioning whether or not the all-volunteer force serves the country's interests. And even more surprising, at least to me, General Stanley McChrystal, the commander in Afghanistan, cashiered by President Obama, has publicly stated in a lecture format that we need to rethink this. And McChrystal's argument is that when the American people don't have skin in the game, that's the phrase he uses, when the American people don't have skin in the game, then the military gets misused. And he wants the American people to have skin in the game, both in order to try to ensure that the military is not misused, and also, from his point of view, and mine as well, because that will give us a more effective military in the long run, even if it means that we're going to have a bunch of overweight recruits that are going to take more time to whip into shape.
How might the discussion of Syria had been different regarding military strikes and the like if we had skin in the game?
Well, you know, Syria is an interesting case, and Syria, you know, it's one moment, one episode. Where will it lead? Is it a precedent? What does it indicate? It's too soon to tell. But clearly the American people, in their response to President Obama's proposal to attack Syria, demonstrated, not demonstrate, but in the poll numbers at least, showed a reluctance. The sort of free hand that George W. Bush was able to exercise in Iraq and Afghanistan, and that Obama himself was able to exercise, for example, in the so-called Afghanistan surge, something seems to have changed. But whether that change is permanent remains to be seen. But right now, the American people, I don't think out of any particular identity with American soldiers, but perhaps reading the military lessons of the past decade, at this particular moment, the American people seem to have had enough of war, and therefore they're unwilling to give Obama a blank check.
Let's go to Will in Windsor next. Hello, Will. You're on the air.
Yes. I think this whole idea of the professional military service is flawed. When you have a country where our military is sent off to war for profiteers, and that's what it's about. I did two tours in Vietnam, and I understand war. When you have reservists, National Guards that are going serving four or five tours, not to uphold the oath they took, that's where the problem lay. The military-industrial complex have too big a grip on this country. And those that are profiting for it are the ones that advocate war. And until we stop that, and young people now, you can see it with the IDAW, are waking up to that idea that we are not fighting to defend or preserve the Constitution or the interests of this country. It's when those changes will come.
Thank you very much, Will. So, Professor Basevich, those who advocate for war profit from war?
Well, I'd expand on Will's point a little bit. It's not simply the military-industrial complex, meaning it's not simply defense contractors. There is a national security apparatus, institutions of government partnered to institutions that exist to make money, and they are committed to maintaining the status quo, because the status quo is a source of profit, it's a source of influence, it's a source of status. And so within that orbit, within Washington, it's going to be very difficult to it's unlikely that we'll see any willingness to ask first-order questions about our military system. And it's for that reason that, I mean, that the book argues that if there's going to be change in U.S. national security policy that moves us to a wiser, more prudent course, then the pressure for change has to come from below, has to come from the people. And that's never going to happen unless the people acknowledge that they ought to play a role in the national security policy, in defending the country. I mean, George Washington, if you want an authority, stated that citizenship ought to entail an obligation to contribute to the country's defense. As on so many other matters, he was right. We have forgotten that, and we need to restore that principle as the foundation of our military system.
Let's go to Victor in Milwaukee next. Hello, Victor.
Good morning, Joy. Good morning to your guests. I'm still in the Armed Forces myself. I still serve in the U.S. Navy Reserve. I fully support national service. My emphasis would be not just international, but what are you doing for your own country? You know, with the training that I get in the Armed Forces, for in particular, like CBR training, chemical warfare, biological, radiological, disasters can happen in a society. You have natural disasters. Someone in serving for national service could get trained on how to respond to what's going on as far as natural disasters or, you know, domestic terrorism. Another point I like to bring up is immigration. What better way to become a citizen of the United States is for an immigrant to learn what it is to become a U.S. citizen. So that should be considered a path to citizenship for immigrants.
What do you think of that, Professor Basevich?
Well, I mean, by and large, I agree. I mean, a program of national service arguably would have many secondary benefits. I was emphasizing the benefit of a richer understanding of what citizenship should entail. But I think it's also possible to argue, people have argued, that those sorts of experiences, whether it's the experience of going through basic training with people who come from other walks of life, other parts of the country, or whether it's sharing in the experience of Teach for America from people who are different from you are, that there is a way, this provides an opportunity to forge a national identity, a sense of sharing things in common. I mean, there are times when it seems that the only thing we share is our propensity for consumption, and that does not provide the basis for a flourishing democracy. Not only flourishing economically, but flourishing morally. So. National service, to my mind, is not simply an antidote to a flawed military system, but can actually be a source of a wider array of benefits.
Thank you, Victor, for the call. Mike in Appleton is next. Hello, Mike.
Yeah, good morning. Professor, a couple of questions. First, I agree with the disconnect that exists, you know, with the younger people and the reality around them. It's a total disconnection. But from a historical perspective, I would ask you, what should our policy be with regards to the next problem, which is going to be Iran?
Well, are you, can you put that into the context of our discussion, Professor Bacevich?
I don't think so. I mean, I can take a stab at answering the question, but, you know, what to do about Iran is not something that I take up in the book. And my view would be as follows. There is no good to be served in engaging in a preventive war with Iran, as some people have advocated. We tried preventive war in Iraq, and we should have learned our lesson that it doesn't work. It yields painfully unintended consequences. I would argue that the Iranian regime is rational. Now, people could point to former President Ahmadinejad and say, boy, he sure didn't seem to be rational, and that may well be the case in terms of his behavior. It's also true that Ahmadinejad exercised fairly limited authority, particularly in the realm of national security. But if you look at the regime's behavior, they are rational. That is, they do not court their own self-destruction. And if they are rational, they can be deterred. In other words, even if, we don't know for sure, even if the new president says they're not trying to develop nuclear weapons, but even if they are, my argument would be they can be deterred. And we should begin now to establish a basis for an effective strategy of deterrence to try to ensure that they will not invite their own destruction. So we don't need a war with Iran. In many respects, I think we need to examine very carefully the invitation for negotiations that we're currently hearing from Tehran.
Well, in our final moments here, what would it take for the country to institute a national service policy like the one you're advocating?
Yeah, you know, I'd like to see, we're not going to see it, I'm sure, but, I mean, I'd like to see the president create a commission, have a presidential commission on national service that would, a group of distinguished Americans from different walks of life who could evaluate this idea. And certainly the idea is not original with me. This is something that kind of cycles through our politics once a decade. Let's examine the pros and the cons, the challenges of implementation. And a commission of that type would also then serve to promote the conversation, to bring the issue into our politics so that perhaps Congress could then give it serious consideration. So I think a commission on national service would be a very useful first step.
Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Andrew Bacevich, professor of history and international relations at Boston University. His most recent book is Breach of Trust: How Americans Failed Their Soldiers and Their Country. Thanks to Christy Taylor for producing and directing this program. Thanks to Bill Martins for on-air production. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I hope that you will join us tomorrow at this time. We will talk with the author of The War on Football about the threats he sees facing America's signature sport. That's The War on Football. Is there one? Tomorrow. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.